Welcome back to Dating Games, a modern relationships podcast. I'm your host, Bobby Temps, and our guest this week is best known as America's relationship expert, sharing much revered advice across TV, radio, podcasting, and increasingly viral social media videos, which is actually how I found you. As a clinical psychologist, their perspective explores the depth of human connection in a very realistic and actionable way. So to explore some of life's dating hurdles, please welcome Dr. Wendy Walsh.
Hi, Bobby. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, it's great to catch up with you. And I'm really looking forward to hearing your perspective because, like I said there, you've got a way of distilling these experiences that can be so confusing in a way that is like quite black and white, which a lot of people I would think is oversimplifying, but I find you're so spot on a lot of the time.
Well, I'm also backed by a lot of science. Mm-hmm. My story is that I spent half my life trying to figure out what I got wrong with love and why dating was so hard, why finding a mate and keeping a mate was so hard. And in midlife, I went back to school and got a master's and PhD in psychology, where I specialize in attachment theory, the ways that we attach across the lifespan. And I read relationship science all day long, the biological, the psychological, and the social pieces. And because my primary career was as a journalist, I'm pretty good at turning this stuff into language everybody can understand. So yeah, it seems black and white, but it's always backed by data.
I love that. And so to start off, do you have a dating story to share?
One of my favorite stories actually has to do with my very first relationship in life when I was just a teenager. And it's to illustrate how people with and what I call an anxious attachment style perceive threats of abandonment all the time. And they often will pick partners who will confirm their belief because they're people who can't get their needs met. And I had this boyfriend in high school. I lived in Toronto, Canada. He moved out as soon as he was a year older than me. He graduated high school and he moved out west to Edmonton to work on the oil rigs. That's very common. Men, young boys move out west, make some money. And so we were having a telephone relationship. This is before the internet, before the luxury of Zoom and Skype and text all day long. And because long distance calls were very expensive then, we could only call at 11 p.m. So it was 11 p.m. I was on the phone with him and I did something that many people with an anxious attachment style do. We do it unconsciously. We try to make the partner jealous to bring him closer. I didn't even realize that my model for love was filled with longing. So I told him that there was this guy at work that was asking me out and I was kind of interested in him. And as soon as I said the words, the phone disconnected. Now, somebody with an anxious attachment style, there's only one of two things that could happen there. Someone murdered him or he jumped off a balcony. Only possibilities in my brain. So my 18-year-old brain called the Edmonton police force and said, you've got to go there right away. Well, it turns out he had not even hung up on me. The phone line had just become disconnected. But this is how anxious attachment style plays out. And that set the tone for a lifetime of dating emotionally avoidant playboys who confirmed my belief that I wasn't lovable.
Yes, I can see that. And the way that your mind goes to that extreme place. And wow, what a story. So whilst we're confessing attachment styles, we did a whole episode on it previously. And I found out that I'm avoidant. And and it opened up a lot.
We'd be a great couple for each other. Unfortunately, a painful couple, but the research says we'd stay together a very long time.
Yeah. And so often that's referred to, right? The anxious avoidant trap, that these opposing perspectives can so often be drawn to each other because they sort of complement each other in a way that continues the feelings of stress, but it's a familiar
stress. They confirm each other's faulty model of love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I found out as part of that, that there was a lot of patterns in my history of dating a lot of avoidant people. And I was like, I was trying so hard to find all these ways in which these relationships and how they didn't work out made sense. And actually, maybe this one thing explains a lot of it.
Yeah. I look through the lens of attachment theory at everything in life, workplace relationships, parent-child relationships, friendships, romantic adult attachment. You start to, once you know somebody's attachment style, you can almost predict their behavior.
Because I'd learned about it in psychology back at A level, and I'd never even known that it could be applied to relationships. I'd learned about it in how it forms in terms of as a young child and from there. And so that was such an eye opener to be like, oh, these patterns really stick with us, and that's quite scary. But if you know it and you know what type you are, that can be the first step.
Oh, it's always the first step. Recognize it. My favorite story that's a metaphor for the stages of change with attachment style is, I want you to imagine that your attraction to people who will hurt you is a hole in the street. And so you're walking down the street, you don't see the hole, and you fall in it. But then someone explains to you about attachment style, you understand yourself better. And this time you're walking down the street and you see that hole very clearly and you fall in it. But stage three is you walk down the street, you see that hole, and you use your prefrontal cortex and you make behavioral changes and you very carefully step around that hole. But stage four is you take a different street. And I think that when you know your attachment injuries are healed is when you find yourself being attracted to somebody who you might never have considered in the past. And when you're in that relationship with them, you don't have the feelings of anxiety or the feelings of being smothered or the feelings that they're too needy or the feelings that they're abandoning you. You have feelings of just calm, trust, security, peace. That's what real love and a good, healthy human bond feels like.
Yeah. And yet so often it is elusive and we find ourselves going for the same kind of people and then wondering like, oh, why didn't it work out this time? They were so similar to my ex.
They're the same person. They may be wearing a different shirt. They may even be a different gender. They may be driving a different car, but the feeling is the same.
And would you mind sharing a bit of what that process was like for you getting past the anxious model?
Well, there's research to show that there are three kinds of relationships that can really heal any kind of attachment injury. One is obviously the therapist-patient relationship. No matter what kind of degree or license your therapist has, it is the safety of that relationship and the consistency of that relationship where it's every Friday at 10 o'clock and your brain kind of rewires itself into knowing that good mommy will be there in a consistent way. The other is the parent-child relationship. Plenty of people with insecure attachment styles still manage to get pregnant or get people pregnant and have kids. And so if you choose to do something different than your parents did to you and practice attachment parenting and stay close to your kids, then as you're soothing your baby, it's okay, daddy's going to be home soon. It's okay, mommy's right here. Your own brain is listening and it actually can heal your own brain. And the third relationship is if you pick somebody who has a secure attachment style, they stay pretty stable while you wing out and eventually you calm down. And so I had the benefit of all three. I had a good therapist for many, many years. I had two children I was raising and reading all these attachment parenting books. I wore my babies. I breastfed each of my babies for 3 years. I kept my babies in their bed. They never had a crib. They slept with me. They're all very independent, by the way. There is a misunderstanding that keeping a baby close will create dependency, but it actually creates security so that they can be brave and leave. It is actually the child that's pushed away too early that becomes the clingy, dependent one. And finally, you know, I met somebody who could tolerate my little bit of craziness, right? So I could say to him, hey, like I remember just weeks after dating, he was in one city on business and late at night, too late to call me. He had another call to go to another city to do business. So he quickly hopped on a late night flight and didn't let me know. And the next day when he called me later in the day, he said, oh, by the way, I'm in this new city now. And my whole attachment organization just completely deregulated at that moment. And I'm like, what? Like, because people with an anxious attachment style have an internal locator. They need to know where that person is all the time. And I'm like, you would get on a plane, go to a different city, not even think to send me a text saying, hey, by the way, I'm here now. I used to say to my children, always text me when you change locations because I need to know which direction to run if there's an earthquake. But that was really my anxious attachment talking, right? Mm-hmm. And so he was like, oh, you're absolutely right. I'm so sorry. In fact, why don't we open phone locator on right now so you can always see where I am at all times will that help you feel better? I'm like, yes. And then he was like, and next time I promise I'll text you whenever. I didn't know it mattered to you, but sure. I mean, he's so secure that it wasn't like, ew, she's being needy. She's being weird. He had a secure attachment style. He was like, oh, okay. Like, how do we just fix this? Great. So now we sort of have a running joke because every once in a while, you know how Apple will change their settings or you get a new phone and the locator goes off and I'll be like, is it you or is it Apple? How come I can't find you? But actually I never checked. Now we've been together a year and a half and I never ever checked the locator. It's very funny. I was talking to him recently and I said, what time are you going to be here? He goes, you mean you haven't even looked at the locator? I said, I haven't looked at the locator in 6 months. I don't know. So that's when you know you're healed.
That's great to hear. And I love that. I love those kind of relationship in jokes that people have. And if people are unfamiliar with this, then we should maybe share a little bit about these different types. So essentially, an oversimplified version may be that due to factors like how you were raised, past relationships, particularly with your parents, we have usually one of three main attachment styles. So they define how you react a lot of the time to like stressful situations or anything you perceive as issues in a relationship. So an anxious person may get really worried and may go overboard of how can I do everything to keep this person close. An avoidant person may do the opposite, where they push back and they want to reassert their independence as a way to feel comfortable and they're not relying on this person. And then a secure person is not, like I think a lot of people think, a perfect middle. They're just more in the middle. And so they may have a more balanced view of, okay, they haven't texted me back in a little while, but I look back over the other texts and it's not that much longer since they usually text me back. And depending on the combination of what you and your partner may be, can really exacerbate these behaviors.
And that's such an excellent description. Thank you for that. And I also want to remind everybody that not only is it a scale, but to complicate things even more, you might express different attachment styles with different people, depending on what they enliven in you. You know, every person we meet in life enlivens a piece of our personality, right? And so basically, the bottom line is, and it's partly genetic, by the way, and also how you were parented. So the baby, when they're under stress, reaches out for care because a 100% vulnerable, dependent newborn, their entire survival mechanism is about whether they can get some giant person to care for them, to pick them up if in their anthropological past, if a dangerous lion came towards them, to feed them if they were hungry, to keep them warm if they were cold. And so this becomes, if that person wasn't there in a consistent way, people go one of two directions, basically. They either go to the anxious side where they realize that they can't trust that the person will really be there for them. So they've got to do all these, we call it proximity seeking behaviors, to try to get that person close to them. And there's all kinds of drama that people do to try to get a mate to get closer, from big bursts of anger to making them feel jealousy, to like not talking to them and blocking them to make them come forward. There's all kinds of things. And at the other end might be somebody who says, okay, so I can't depend on anybody. It's all about me. I've got to be 100% independent and I can only trust myself, right? So we should not get caught up in the categories and the words, but instead talk about what it just feels like to us. But I think I would fall on what we call the avoidant fearful versus the avoidant dismissive, which I suspect you're describing yourself as. And the avoidant dismissive is when they're stressed, they dismiss other people's stress because it brings up feelings in their own, like I can't tolerate what you're trying to express to me. But also when they're expressing themselves, they move away from people because they don't trust that people could help them. Whereas the avoidant fearful is more like, come closer, come closer, come closer. I need you. But if you show up, I don't trust it. So I'm going to do everything I can to push you away and keep you in this comfortable buffer zone, a little bit close and a little bit pushed away. So, I mean, just becoming aware of it is really the big step to changing our attachment style.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I'm definitely finding that even not having done much work on it, but knowing which type I am, I can start to see the behaviors or see the behaviors in other people. But it does take some coming to terms with, doesn't it? Because we can struggle to acknowledge how much our early childhood experiences still influence us now. And we want to feel like we're grown up and we're past so many things and we're so independent. And me as an avoidant person, I definitely value my independence very highly. And so sometimes it can feel like too straightforward. But if we sit with this stuff, and I'd encourage listeners to go back to the episode, I'll link it in the episode description, and we do a questionnaire where you can find out which type you are as well.
I think that it's important to understand that these early life experiences, especially the ones that happened when we were pre-verbal, really become the driver of the car. When I had a private practice, people would say to me, "Now, do you do adult or do you do child psychology?" And I would respond by saying, "It's all child psychology. It just happens in adult bodies."
And I've had to explain it in that way before to people, where it's so often our places of fear in ourselves take us back to those very early days. So you can be an adult and you can have your grown-up logical way of dealing with things until something really stressful happens, or something happens that particularly brings you back to early memories. And then you go to being that scared kid.
And, you know, I want to remind people that feelings are not dangerous. We spend a lot of time, you know, Freud called them defense mechanisms, using these mechanisms to defend against psychic pain. Rationalization is a good one. And instead, if we just stopped and expressed our feelings in small ways along the way, there would be no big dramas. And, well, there's new research to show that some of the healthiest couples who stay together the longest and report the most feelings of well-being actually argue the most. But they don't have big knockdown, drag them out, huge fights. What they have is little border skirmishes all the time. And so they're able to constantly express their feelings and negotiate their boundaries in small, loving ways all the time. And this actually creates a protection against big, painful, hurtful fights.
Mm. I love that. And I definitely noticed that pattern in my own life, where I don't quite trust the couples that never fight, because I wonder what things are not being said there.
I call them those happy roommates only living in the public areas of the house. Like, they really don't have intimacy. Not that, you know, I also want to be clear, there should be no judgment here, in the sense that if somebody has an avoidant attachment style, they have learned that they can't trust others, and they have found coping strategies to survive in life. You know, when I hear anxious girls, and, you know, I got like a million of them on my TikTok channel, say, "Oh, those avoidant playboys, he knew, he ghosted me, he knew that hurt, he knew." I'm like, no, he didn't. And it's not his fault. That's his coping mechanism. But my question to you is, why are you spending all your time analyzing him instead of figuring out why you were attracted to that in the first place? Right? So we should not judge each other's attachment style. There's only one person whose happiness we're responsible for, and it's ours. And if we go on to enter a healthy relationship, we need to drag in suitcases, heavy luggage full of happiness, because we're going to need to unpack those bags and share them with our partner.
Mm-hmm. This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ Mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, Great mission. Go to iqbar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all iqbar products plus free shipping. That's iqbar.com, promo code KELLER20.
And talking about the girls on TikTok that you're mentioning there, you've sort of reminded me of a phenomenon I'm increasingly seeing where people, and I would say it's more commonly men, but I'll say people, expect a certain amount of features of a relationship with somebody new that they're getting to know without actually stepping up and asking them to be in a relationship. And that person, and I think particularly if you have an anxious attachment style, you can fall quite prey to this, where you're so keen to get them to stay that you'll go along with this behavior and go along with their expectations. And actually, they should have had the bravery to set out, will you go out with me? Let's set some boundaries.
It is heartbreaking how many, particularly women and some men, are in what I call situationships, where they're in a sexual relationship with somebody. They may go out in public. They're probably not socializing with their friends and family, almost like they're a side chick. And they're too afraid to ask for relationship definition, the what are we conversation. When actually those people who have a secure attachment style are fearless about asking for their needs to be met very early on. And it just breaks my heart because for women, okay, so you have to understand, and you know, I hate to sound so heteronormative because the truth is attachment style can cross every gender, every sexual orientation. But women's unique biology is sex is mostly a biology, right? Gender is a cultural construct. So women's unique biology means that sex is a much higher risk hobby for women than it is for men. Women, because of their unique biology, are more likely to contract an STI. Women, because of their unique biology, are more likely to fall in love through hookups because their bodies are emitting so much oxytocin, the big bonding hormone. The only other time in a woman's life where she emits so much oxytocin is during breastfeeding to bond with her baby. And also, women are still much more likely than men to contract an 18-year case of parenthood. And so yet these women who wouldn't give the keys to their apartment to a strange man to water their plants while they're out of town would expose their eggs and their bloodstream. And this is how attachment anxiety works. They're more afraid of that person leaving if they express their need for definition, their need for birth control, their need for whatever. And so that's what breaks my heart because they write to me and they are in pain. And they want to know how to fix this. And I often say it's too late. If you've been spending 6 months giving him free sex and he's had to pay nothing for it. And when I say pay, I mean, we should be charging the highest price for sex, which is care and commitment. And if they're not getting the care and they're not getting the commitment, then nothing's going to change unless they can be brave and ask for it.
Absolutely. And I think in absence of that, you so often see this pattern where the person that's not committing will have a set of expectations that they'll act funny if you mention somebody else that you might be interested in, or they'll flip out if you don't have enough free time for them and all of these things. And then you're dealing with that behavior rather than dealing with, no, but why do you have these expectations? We're not together.
Exactly. Which confirms their belief I'm not lovable enough. And, you know, I had a conversation with a man once, and as a woman hearing this, it was hysterical to me, but there are many men out there who think this way. He said, you know, I've been in this sexual relationship with this woman for 6 months, and we have sex once, sometimes twice a week. And we had established at the beginning that this was just going to be a friends with benefits. This was just going to be a sexual relationship. So she called me and she asked me, where is this relationship going? Why would she ask that? He said, this is not our deal. Every woman hearing that is going to be going, of course, that's what she's going to ask. And every man is like, yeah, didn't you have a deal? But the problem is that biology gets involved. And once you get that assault of a cocktail of neurohormones on your brain chemistry of the sex hormones, you're going to start to become attached. Your bodies become attached. listen, I warn ladies all the time, be careful who you hook up with. You might fall in love with them. And you can literally hook up with a really inappropriate person and have all these feelings, a cascade of neurohormones that create a feeling of love. So yeah.
And I've seen friends do that. And I think at times been guilty of that myself, where you maybe see how things go with somebody who feels like lower stakes to you. You know, you're like, oh, this might be more comfortable. We'll see where this will go. I'm not really sure if they're the right fit. And then, of course, well, it's not long until they're a key person in your life. And the person that might be a better fit, you're too busy dealing with this one.
Yep. I do want to add here, and I think it's really important that I say this, that none of what I am saying comes from a place of moral direction or moral sensibility. There are two people who get together who have emotionally avoidant attachment styles. They are very independent. They have sex-only relationships, and it works for both of them. I only have a problem when it doesn't work for one of the people. And one of the people is in there because they're trying to get the love that they deserve, and they're unable to get their needs met. That's what I focus on. I don't care if you want to hook up, if you want to have short-term relationships, enjoy, use protection, have fun. But I get into the deeper dynamics of people who really want, I mean, we're wired to bond. As human beings, it's our basic survival instinct to bond with another human. And when people who want that are unable to do it, there's a lot of pain, and psychic pain is very much like physical pain.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I know that you talk a lot about is gender differences around communication. And like you, I think a lot of the way we talk about gender can be bound up in stereotypes, but because of the way that we're socialized, I think there really can be such differences on the way we communicate, and particularly communicate our feelings.
I think we are at a great time in history where so many men are finally being let out of the man box. This very narrow definition of what masculinity was. For instance, it had to be heteronormative behavior. You had to suck it up and not show any tender feelings. The only feelings that you were allowed to express were aggression or competition or anger. This idea that a man must defend himself and even use aggression. You know, there was a research done, a pretty big longitudinal study in three countries, the UK, USA, and Mexico. And they looked at seven pillars of masculinity and how deep men were trapped into this man box. And they found actually the men who were most trapped were the Americans, and followed by the men in the UK, but the Latinx men in Mexico were a little warmer with expressing their feelings. And so I think it's a time where men can be human beings, you know, and we don't have to put masculine or femininity on feelings. But I want to say this, patriarchy also swims around in the background of women's brains. And so women will say about men, oh, he's too weak, or I don't want a man who will cry. I need a strong, silent man, right? So they're also not reinforcing this positive change in men. And so I always advise women to understand that inside every man is a 10-year-old boy before he was acculturated to suck it up. And if you can connect with him, he will love you forever.
Mm. I think that's such a wonderful way of putting it. And it does sort of break my heart sometimes to think about how, in its extreme, it can really deprive men of love, of feeling it, of being able to show it, if you feel you have to push your emotions down so far. And that's one of so many ironies of this narrow idea of masculinity, because then that's going to compromise your ability to get in a relationship and be the man of the house, or whatever other stereotypes you might be trying to fulfill.
You know, I tell these very successful, quote unquote, alpha women, you know what, your idea of a power guy might just be a guy who can power a stroller. Think about what your needs are for a best friend, right? If you're going to reproduce, if you want to stay out there slaying dragons and bringing in the money, great, good for you. But to run a household, there are all kinds of domestic responsibilities, and somebody's got to do some of the other work.
And if we touch on the very early stages of communication, I think this can be where it's really exacerbated some of these differences. Let's say you've met through a dating app, or maybe someone's introduced you, or you've met someone out and about and you've got their number, and your messaging, and that already deprives you of a lot of the context of the conversation. But then I think the way that men and women try and understand each other's messages can be quite different.
Well, let's go to the very beginning, how men and women use dating apps differently. Mm-hmm. So men swipe on literally every woman because they want to see which woman is going to match with them. So they basically say, yeah, because men, there's so much research to support this, are just less choosy. They will always take a woman for free sex. Not every man and not every time, everybody. I don't want to hear you on Twitter, okay? But the research shows that men are far less choosy. And even if they're not looking for to have a relationship with a woman, they may want to have a sexual relationship with her. Women, on the other hand, are looking very carefully at your profile, studying every photograph, trying to decide if the lamp in the background was bought at IKEA or Restoration Hardware. They are trying to figure out who you are. They are reading the words you put in your profile and imagining all the things they mean. And then they match on the three guys that they think are perfect, and they put all their energy into these three guys, but they don't understand those three guys have 40 women in their message boxes. And so those guys are sending one or two word answers because they're just so busy. And the anxious girl just get more hyped up for him. And then you get into the whole texting. First of all, dating apps shouldn't be called dating apps. They're meeting apps. You use them to meet somebody and then get in the real world quickly, right? Otherwise you get addicted to the app, and messaging on an app is not good. Get on the phone very quickly. Then the other thing is, once you're sort of starting to get to know this person, don't have a text relationship. Have a phone relationship. Have a face-to-face relationship. Texting is devoid of all vocal tone, body language, even pheromones. And it's like listening to your favorite band without the vocalist or the drummer. Like, you're really missing half the song.
Yeah. And yet it's so normalized, this way of meeting people now, that we can get easily drawn into it. And I've certainly done this. I've seen a lot of friends do this where, like you say, you really put in the effort. You think, okay, this person looks good on paper. I don't really know anything about them, but hypothetically they could be a good person. And I'm going to put in all this effort. You know, if they're not messaging me back much, then I'll go more to try and push things forward. And I think the trap that I certainly see with that is then you're setting up the relationship right from the very, very early stages for you to be doing more of the work. And if they can't even text you back promptly with more than a one-word answer, think of the things further down the road that you're going to have to badger them to do.
We value, people of all genders, value what we have to work for and what we invest more in. And so if you allow someone to give very little investment, you're cashing in your value. It's better that you give them the gift of allowing them to court you and take some time with you, because they'll value you more.
I know. And it's a difficult lesson to learn, isn't it? Because it feels counterintuitive to be like, okay, pull back a little bit if you want them to pull forward.
And when women say to me, oh, you know, times have changed. No, our biology hasn't. I'm an evolutionary psychologist. We are trapped in ancient biology that's operating outside of our conscious awareness. So forget about cultural norms changing about women texting men first. I'm going to tell you that if you start chasing him, he's going to devalue you.
It's sad to hear, isn't it? Sometimes that you're like, oh, we're still dealing with this stuff. All the progress that has been made, gender equality and autonomy of women, but these traps are still there. And I think people of all genders would happily have somebody scoop them up and I think settle for a lower match of partner if that person is going to make all the effort. You know, that's another way we could look at it.
I wouldn't call that a lower match of partner. I would call that a higher match of partner. My point is that remember I said relationships are biological, psychological, and social. Our dating apps and our profiles are the social piece. How much money do they make? What's their political affiliation? Are they vegan or a carnivore, right? That's the social piece of it. And so we have this list of social things that we want that become the surface. But once you're in a relationship, none of those things matter. You're in like glue based on the attachment dynamic. And I really think like you only have to find one, that one needle in the haystack who is totally impassioned by you, who's totally excited to meet you. You know, a great example is, you know, I had my two or three guys in the inbox on the dating app when I met my boyfriend, and they were answering me with one words or stupid stuff. Ooh, what are you doing this weekend? What's your week look like? You know, it's like, please get into real stuff. And I was using Bumble, and Bumble is the app where if you don't respond to a match, women, within 24 hours, he kind of disappears. But he can rematch with you to kind of let you know that you're important. In fact, women have told me that they use the rematch technique as a way to tell if they should talk to a guy. In other words, if they match with a whole bunch of guys, they let them all expire in 24 hours. They see which ones rematch. So they use it as a filter.
Ooh, right? That's so clever, because then you're hacking
the
whole...
Isn't that clever? If he really cares, he's going to hit that button and rematch with me when the match expires. And so I didn't even know how the app worked. But one day I sat down at the app and I was going to go back into the deck, and I saw a bunch of kind of grayed out faces at the top. And those are the guys who the match expired, but they had rematched. I didn't know that. And I said to myself, oh, well, if I liked these guys once, maybe I'd like them again. Let me click on somebody I've already liked before. So I click on the man who had become my boyfriend. And all I wrote was the word hi, because I believe that women don't need to chase men. And if you just say hi, that's all you need, right? And the text that came back instantly, because he had notifications on, was shocking. It was Wendy, all in caps, with four exclamation marks. What happened to you? I rematched with you three times and then you disappeared. And now here you are back. Oh my God, can we jump on the phone? I looked at that text and I was like, here's a guy who's actually into me. This is amazing. Obviously, I had all kinds of other criteria and he passed those tests in the next few weeks. But that's the person you want to match with. The person is really excited by you at the beginning, who thinks you're a big deal. And hopefully you should think they're a big deal too.
I love all of that. You get some points right there. That's brilliant. And so we'll move on then to our rules of the game. So you've already given so many great takes, but is there something else you would recommend, a rule that people can try and live by in dating and relationships?
Never have a first date before having a coffee date. Imagine this. You meet somebody on an app, you think they're great, but you don't really know who they are. You're texting, you're looking at a fake profile. You might next week, you might go on a bad date with them, and then a week later, walk into a business meeting and they're there. Or find out that your friend is now dating them. Even in big cities, these people are part of your peer group. So you might say something like, hey, you know, I don't know if romance is in the cards for us or whether you're going to be a great business contact or I want to fix you up with one of my friends. Why don't we meet for a quick coffee? So you meet for a 20-minute coffee where you have a clear time schedule. I got a quick getaway, right? And then after that coffee, just sit and wait to see if they contact you to go out on a date. But then there's no bad blood. If you run into them in any other way, it's been very casual and light. And it wasn't like somebody had to get dressed up or somebody had to spend a whole bunch of money to be completely disappointed. And then it's really awkward. So your first meeting should always be a coffee date with very low stress. And then wait and see if they call you and ask you for a date.
Great. And I'm going to expand on a point you made earlier about saying hi, because I was listening to the Tinder podcast recently, their own branded one. And I was surprised, I can't remember the percentages, but just how high the proportion of people are that send hi or hey as the first message. And we think about it as a stereotype, but clearly the numbers back up how common that is.
And well, that's a problem if men are doing it, because sperm chases egg, they're wired with testosterone, they're supposed to impress, they should have a great sentence ready. But women, an egg is sitting there waiting to take applications. All she needs to do is say hi.
Okay, well, all right, we'll see what you think of what my rule was going to be then. So I was going to say that a lot of the time we can find with the dating apps that there's just so many people out there and it can feel quite a stretch to talk to everyone and think of original things to say. I think you're maybe going to say that men should have things locked and loaded. What I was going to say is, you're nodding. What I was going to say is that if you find, let's say you match with somebody, like late in the evening, you're too tired to think of something, saying hi is surely better than that match being something you never come back to.
Yeah, absolutely.
We'll allow that.
Yes, not texting is the worst thing. Matching and not texting, even though I did that and then pulled my boyfriend back out of the fish pond. But yeah, saying something. If you're going to match with somebody, at least say something and start the conversation. But I also believe that you should not get into a long texting relationship. Within 3 or 4 texts, somebody's got to give up the phone number. Say you want to jump on the phone, because that should be your next level of investigation.
Ooh, that's faster than I do. I'm going to try that out.
Oh, yeah. The art of finding a great mate is the art of eliminating thousands of bad mates. And so you shouldn't be thinking, I'm looking for the one. You should be thinking of, how can I get rid of this person? Because eventually, if you throw every little straw out of the haystack, that one perfect needle is lying there. So it's all about tossing out early in a kind way, because these are human beings. So I had always, after that first phone call, when, because I knew in a first phone call, I'm a sapiosexual, they weren't smart enough and I wasn't stimulated, I wasn't moving forward, no matter how pretty their pictures were. And so I did have a canned text that usually I'd personalize at the beginning. So it might say something like, hey, it was great talking to you on the phone. You know, good luck at your daughter's wedding next month. I don't think romance is in the cards for us, but I'll definitely keep you in mind for a friend sometime. And I just sent that. Now, no man ever wrote back, you bitch. They often would not respond at all from that text, but plenty of men wrote back, thank you. Nice talking to you too. And thanks for not ghosting me.
Yeah. No, I think that's lovely. Yeah, well, that's it. Why can't you be a good experience for somebody just because you don't work out?
Yeah.
No, I think
that's what some men said, which was highly flattering. They would say, I didn't think a girl like you would go out with me anyway, but that was amazing conversation.
I love that. But no, I think this is good. And I think whatever you can do to at least make some effort to have the conversation begin is a great way to not get hooked on the apps and hooked on the matching and the dopamine hit of getting another match. And instead, what we're actually looking for, which is starting a conversation.
Yeah, you're looking to talk to human beings in the real world. So get off the apps very quickly.
All right, we will start wrapping up there then. If people want to find more of your insights online, where should they go?
My social media everywhere is at Dr. Wendy Walsh. In the last month, I've opened up my very first Patreon page, which I got to tell you, Bobby, I love it. Because the difference between social media, where you're just posting videos and content and people put little, you know, comments, I actually run private Zoom rooms where we get in and have group discussions about dating and relationships or the science of love. I've put all my podcasts behind the paywall on Patreon. It's as little as $4 a month. I put all my articles and blogs. I have a love science education program that some of my university teaching for people who want to be on that tier. But for that, you just go to patreon.com/Dr. Wendy Walsh. And I'm telling you, I love it. I love my Patreons and I give them so much attention. I give them access to me. I do a weekly drawing for a private one-on-one phone session with me every week. And so I really, that's the place where I go on first thing every morning and answer people's questions. I like to think of my patrons, I guess, as my employers. So I'm very honored that they're there on my Patreon page.
Brilliant. I love that. And if nothing else, I've seen that you've got 2 of your books available via one of the tiers as well. So even just to try out those, I think I'll be joining soon enough.
Great. Come on over. I've actually had a couple of people from Ireland say, you've got to change your Zoom time so that because I'm doing them at 6:30 p.m. Pacific time. So I have a poll out right now with my Patreons trying to figure out what time is going to work because everybody's in so many different time zones. But eventually, where I see my life going. So right now, you know, I work in Los Angeles radio. I have a talk radio show on the most listened to talk radio station in our nation, KFI AM 640 and iHeart radio station. I teach university 2 days a week. And I run my social media, I have various sponsors, et cetera. But I am going to retire sometime just servicing my Patreons. That's my plan, to get rid of everything else and do Zooms at different time zones around the week, all week long. So from my mouth to God's ear, let's make it happen, Bobby.
Yes. So get in now. Get in now before she retires everything else. Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for chatting with me.
Thanks. Good to meet you.
Thanks for listening.
You can support the show, get ad-free episodes and bonus content by joining our new subscription on Apple Podcasts.
This replaces our Patreon and it's slightly cheaper.
Our show is edited and produced by Pete Murta,
with music by the brilliant Tessa Violet.
Speak to you next Friday. Until then, good luck out there.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Buying a car in Carvana was so easy. I was able to finance it through them.
Whoa, wait, you mean finance?
Yeah, finance. Got pre-qualified for a Carvana auto loan, entered my terms, and shopped from thousands of great car options all within my budget.
That's cool that financing through Carvana was so easy.
Financed. Done. And I get to pick up my car from their Carvana vending machine tomorrow.
Financed.
Right, that's what I said.
You can spend time trying to pronounce financing, or you can actually finance and buy your car today on
Carvana.
Financing subject to credit approval. Additional terms and conditions may apply.